This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, we know all about the 1970 Knicks, what about 73? Before we get to the show, I want to tell you guys about Fast Break Breakfast. It's a fellow Harvard Proxism Network podcast. If you watch League Pass every night but aren't listening to Fast Break Breakfast, you are missing out. It's what happens when you get two musicians and a comic who are overeducated, underemployed, but share an obsession about the NBA, 90s movies, and conspiracy theories. So make sure you subscribe to Fast Break Breakfast, a podcast for serious NBA fans that is incredibly not serious. All right, I am Jason, and we are back talking about more basketball mysteries of the 1970s. I am joined once again by Raphael of the NBA Trades blog, podcast, and Twitter account. You had a great episode recently talking to David Steele, who covered the mid-90s Golden State Warriors and getting into their struggles and the Latrell Spiro situation. You do a great job of finding really good guests for the podcast and kind of a mix of different, you know, professional perspectives and fan perspectives, but they've all been really good hits. So appreciate what you bring to the table. Your site helps me do a lot of research on things when I'm looking into things for shows. So I appreciate that as a resource and appreciate you bringing your expertise to '70s, the New York Knicks. We're going to kind of overview the key players through that, the dynasty, if you want to call it that, they had from, you know, basically 69 to 74, where they were, you know, a pretty good team to title contender type play as they went. But, you know, this is obviously one of the most heavily mythologized teams, really made the NBA, helped really bring a lot of popularity to the NBA, even though the 70s are kind of considered a nadir. At least the early 70s, you know, the league was, you know, a little bit more on the minds of people. It helped get a lot of coverage that they hadn't gotten before. The 1970 finals with, you know, LA versus New York was a big deal. And you know, Bob Ryan called it, you know, the most important finals in NBA history in terms of, you know, kind of bringing popularity to the league, which, you know, says a lot, I think. They won two NBA titles and reached three finals in five seasons. The 1970 team was one of the most dominant NBA teams of the decade, top 20 ever in SRS, the basketball reference rating system for team strength. Harvey Ayrton, who wrote a great book, When the Garden Was Eden, which was also made into a 30 for 30 documentary, he wrote, in a very chaotic time in the country, and certainly New York City, the Garden was a place where you had people from the outer boroughs, and you had very wealthy people from Manhattan. You had people from Harlem who were very involved with the team. The Knicks were professional basketball. They were centered right in the heart of the city in Midtown, and I do believe it was sort of a unifying experience for the city. Now, you are a Knicks fan. You're not old enough by far to remember this team, but obviously you are part of that fan base. You're part of that, you know of that mythology, and that's part of, you know, kind of embedded into Knicks fandom. How do you feel about this team and the legend that it's been created for in these, you know, past almost 50 years?
Well, it's a really special team. I think they sort of encompass everything from teamwork, team chemistry, and not always, they had great players, obviously, but they never had, like, the best player, you know, like a Jerry West or whatever. But I think that it reflects, and like, the relationship between all of them. I mean, for some reason, that's sort of something that appeals to a lot of people, is just you see, even with Phil Jackson getting hired by the Knicks to run, all of them are always there, like, at the game. So even though the Knicks are terrible now, I think to people it's still amazing to see that, you know, Phil still talks with Clyde, still talks with Willis Reed, still talks with Bill Bradley. They all still have a great relationship. And so I think the idea of, like, people getting along and working together for one common goal always sort of resonates with people, especially when you win a championship. I think it creates a perfect narrative. So I think that's why people really gravitate towards them. And then also the bottom line is just the Knicks have been awful the past, like, especially the past 15 years. So it's really tough for I guess, yeah, like, Knicks fans to really deal with the losing. And so that stretch of, like, 6 years where they're always competing for a title, or they're always, like, sort of at least a fringe contender. I mean, they won two championships, were in the conference finals a bunch of times too. So I think for people it's tough to see that this franchise hasn't really regrouped from obviously the 90s era of Patrick Ewing, where they were a contender. But, you know, this is the only time they've won championships. So for a franchise that doesn't really have much success when you think about it, especially considering the Knicks have been around longer than most NBA franchises, there's not a lot to be happy about or a lot to celebrate. So when you win a championship, it's such an important thing. And so the fact that those two rings matter so much is just reflective of where the Knicks have been as a franchise, especially over the past, you know, 15 years where they haven't won. So it's I think people look back fondly at it because there's not a lot to look back fondly at, like the Celtics, who have different eras of success that, you know, people can constantly look back because they've won so many championships.
You know, they obviously had that blend of amazing talent, those guys who had complementary skills and just kind of fit with each other, you know, Frazier, Reed, DeBuscher, Bradley, Dick Barnett, you know, Phil Jackson, Red Holzman, the coach. I mean, all those guys were characters in the best sense. They came from different backgrounds, different racial mix, different, you know, different parts of the country, you know, different political beliefs. They all, you know, I think the combination of those personalities and how the talent fit on the floor obviously, you know, made them great and made them interesting to mythologize. I mean, obviously, a big part of it is it happened in New York, which is, you know, the place where, other than Los Angeles, the place where dreams are built and, you know, many of our myths are built. But they, you know, they did have a special element to them. I mean, they had a very smart, appreciative crowd. They actually popularized the defense chant. There were 13 books written about them. They were stars of Madison Avenue. They had the New York media. Basically, probably the first basketball team that were also rock stars. So I do think there is a genuine, and, you know, these things are never fair. So it's a little bit sour grapes, but I do think there is a genuine, like, you know, they didn't really accomplish that much in terms of NBA history. Like, the mythology is greater than the actual accomplishments. But, you know, they were a special team. You know, you don't always get the amount of credit that you deserve. I'm using air quotes because you can't see me, obviously, because it's a podcast. But I'm using air quotes for deserve. But, you know, they were a great team, and they were great for this. They were, you know, really an important team for the sport at that time, which was, you know, struggling to get a foothold and helped gain some gains that would later, you know, be capitalized on by the Showtime Lakers and the, you know, the other teams that would rocket, you know, basketball into the stratosphere in the 80s and beyond.
You're right. Like, and, you know, it's funny because, you know, like the two championships and it's not that you're right in the sense that it isn't like a big accomplishment compared to other franchises' success or different eras of, you know, if you're comparing them to the Chicago Bulls with Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, like, no. She said it's New York City. And it's always been said that if you win in New York, it's like the biggest thing ever. And you really can do whatever you want. It's like, you know, not to move aside to another sport, but like the Yankees, like Derek Jeter can do no wrong because he's won all of these championships here. And so it's like, you know, when you win in New York, it's like you're going to get a lot of coverage and you're going to get a lot of attention. And usually, especially with winning, it's positive attention. And so, you know, people are going to write a lot. You're going to get a lot of books written about you. You're going to get a lot of attention. And the Knicks definitely, I mean, they relished in it. And I think that they're looked at as one of the greater teams in league history, just because I think the factor of being in New York City definitely has amplified it.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at kind of the key players for the team, I think first is, or you could go kind of 1A, 1B here, but I would say Walt Frazier, probably the best player overall, probably the genuine, like, you know, during the time in which they were, you know, a good team, a great team from 69 to 74, probably the best point guard in the league. I mean, he averaged 20.8 points per game, 6.6 rebounds per game, 6.9 assists per game, and had a .206 win shares for 48, which is really great. I do think he gets lost a little bit in terms of the great point guards of all time. I mean, I think he's just a tier below your Magics and Oscar Robertsons and absolute best of the best point guards. I mean, he was a terrific floor general, amazing, great defender who was very fast with his hands, but also would be very crafty and would sometimes save his steals for key moments. And, you know, not to mention, you know, being a fashion icon, being the first NBA player to have a shoe named after him, had the Clyde by Puma, and really, you know, helped lead the team. Seven-time all-defense first team, was all-NBA first team four times and second team two times during that time. So hard to say enough about him. Flashy was just, you've got a lot of attention for the team. Obviously, still gets a lot of attention for the team, being the broadcaster and having the colorful phraseology that he's known so well for.
Oh, yeah. I think that's the most appealing thing about him right now. his classic rhyming. But yeah, I think, you know, he does get overlooked a little bit when you think about the best point guards in like league history. And I mean, he was their best player, especially like being the younger part of the duo. Yeah, he definitely, I don't know. And it's funny, cause I don't think people really have a defined place for him in like league history. Like you said, I think he is a little bit below, or people view him as a little bit below that rung of like the top point guards. But I think, I don't know, it's tough. He was a great all around. I think that's the thing that stands out about him, is that he was a great all around player. He's one of the best defensive point guards of all time. And but he could also score. And obviously that game in 1970 is what stands out, that game seven. And so, you know, he's had his moments. And yeah, he's one of the, it's tough. I think it's hard, you know, it's hard to compare him, especially to today's point guard, but I think he really is one of the top point guards of all time. I think, you know, maybe people should people do overlook him a little bit. So I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously considered great, but I think the degree of greatness and like what made him effective compared to some of the other point guards, I think it's lost a little bit in terms of, like, he had a lot of mouths to feed. I mean, like, The Knicks weren't a like, they didn't have one player who needed a lot, but they had a lot of players who needed to be fed, you know, like a medium amount. And that's a tricky balance to make sure all those guys are getting kind of like the right amount. You know, Reed was averaging 18.3 points per game during this time. DeBusschere was averaging 16 points per game. Bradley was averaging 14. Dick Barnett was averaging 13.4. I mean, you start adding those up, and you know, you start introducing guys later that we're going to talk about, Earl Monroe and Jerry Lucas. I mean, keeping all those guys happy, I think, is a, and you know, obviously, you know, they were a team that was willing to pass, so he wasn't the only guy, you know, setting everything up. But I still think that you'd be kind of the prime guy responsible for that, which everyone has kind of agreed with that. In fact, Willis Reed just said, you know, it's Clyde's ball. He just lets us play with it once in a while. I think that, you know, I think he deserves a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, I think so too. I think, it's a lot of responsibility, especially when you're such a deep team. And you, like you said, you have to get the ball to so many different guys to score. Yeah, and he did a good job, especially he was younger than a lot of them. So I think that also is, you know, it's harder too when you're younger and you have to like tell these vets what they should be doing, because you're playing with Dave DeBuscher, who's a veteran who played with Detroit for so long, and Willis Reed, who's a veteran, and so I bet that also had to be hard. So you have to take some kind of like leadership role, especially like, you know, I 23, 24, and you have to be like the guy and tell people where they have to go.
Yeah, which is obviously incredibly difficult to do. By the way, I'm going to mention a book for each of the main players because you know, so many books, you might as well bring them up. And Clyde's main book is Rockin' Steady, A Guide to Basketball and Cool, which was re-released a few years ago. A highly recommended book. It's a great one. He wrote some others as well, but that's sort of the if you want to get the Clyde experience, I feel like that's the one that you want to do. So 1B player that we talk about, and maybe even more famous in a way because of, you know, his obviously the 1970 moment, which we'll talk about, you know, walking on the court after the injury. Willis Reed, the captain of the team, provided a lot of leadership, incredibly competitive and hardworking player, was one-time All-NBA first team, four-time on the second team. And Harvey Ayrton, you know, talked about him as a guy who was always concerned about the welfare of the players, liked to room with one of the rookies, and talked about how he would loan money to his teammates and mediate disputes with their girlfriends, and was generally a very giving guy. There's a story that's talked about in his book and also in the documentary about an issue that he had with Cassie Russell, where Cassie Russell had, you know, been racially profiled while he was in Michigan, and then, you know, he'd been stopped by the police and been harassed, and so he drove to practice later that day or the next day and was fuming about it and basically was beating up on all the white players, and eventually Willis Reed, you know, got in his face, and then Russell called him an Uncle Tom, and obviously just enraged Reed, you know, basically got in his face and said, you know, we can't have this kind of thing. Eventually, you know, was able to kind of deal with that by confronting it, but not letting it escalate to a point where it became, you know, a huge issue for the team. And that was kind of a key moment in them being able to, you know, bond together in an even deeper way, and led to them, you know, having the success that they had.
And he was, I mean, he's the captain, he's the leader of the team, and he had a really big role on the Knicks. And I think that's sort of just the thing is that, also, I think the amazing thing was he was so undersized as a center, as a 6'9", 235-pound center.
Yeah, I mean, he was bulky, but he wasn't that tall.
Yeah, so he had a lot to you know, guard some of the best centers like Will Chamberlain and, you know, Kareem. Like, that's a really good 6'9" guy.
Yeah, and part of what made him effective is he had a good enough, you know, outside shot that he was able to draw a lot of the big men out, which, you know, was able to kind of keep him on the floor and offense. I mean, he had a pretty good inside game too, but that was one advantage he had over most of the centers that he was facing, is that he could, you know, he could shoot from the outside, and, you know, was big enough and strong enough to defend, you know, most of the bigger guys okay, and obviously they had a good defensive system that helped as well. So by this point, he's in his early 30s, but he's been dealing with a bunch of injuries already. In 72, he had only played a handful of games because of injury. He did play in 73. He did play in 69 games, but he averaged only 11 points. He was sharing a lot of time with Jerry Lucas. And then in 74, he retired after playing only 19 games. It was his 10th year. So the injuries really caught up with him, which kind of makes, kind of adds a little bit to his, puts different sort of tinge on, you know, what happened in the 1970 finals with, you know, injuring his knee and taking all the injections to go out there and to make it work. I mean, that was a situation where, you know, his health was starting to deteriorate, and you know, going out there may have been something that, you know, he had to sacrifice, you know, future years in his career to be able to do that.
Yeah, and you know, he just, I think especially like at the end, from what I've read and, like, you know, just certain things that by the end, luckily Jerry Lucas stepped in and became a big part of the team after the trade with Cassie Russell. But, yeah, like, he really did. And maybe some of that is, like, his size, like, you know, led him to be more susceptible to injuries. I don't know. That's unfair because I don't know if it's true or not. But still, you know, his career sort of faded really, not really quickly, but sort in a way, sort of, like,
yeah.
No, where he started dealing with a lot of injuries.
Yeah, and now, you know, shorter careers were still more common then, so, I mean, it wasn't necessarily that uncommon for a guy to retire around 32 or so, but yes, it is a shorter career than, you know, we're definitely used to today, and even by the standards of the day, I mean, it was fairly short. I mean, he retired 1 year after he was Finals MVP, so that, you know, that tells you something right there. By the way, his book was A Will to Win, The Comeback Year, which is the year that he, talking about the 73 season when he, you know, came back from injury and had a pretty successful season. And then next we have Dave DeBuscher, who was power forward, a six-time all-defensive first team. And he had sort of an interesting start to things. He actually played a professional baseball with the, he was a pitcher with the Chicago White Sox. Then he went to the NBA, played for the Pistons, and at the age of 23 was actually the player coach of the team, which says something about the Pistons at that point, that the organization and, you know, what they had, that a 23-year-old was going to be the player coach of the team. But he spent a few years with the Pistons, and then eventually in 69, he was traded to the Knicks for Walt Bellamy. And Bellamy was, you know, was the standout center, but it already kind of bounced around to quite a few different teams. And that move really enabled the Knicks. The pieces kind of really fell together once DeBuscher joined the team. He complimented Reed a lot better. Reed was a lot better playing center. DeBuscher brought in just, you know, the right, you know, like I said, tough mind and defense that they needed, and just kind of shored everything up, brought in leadership, and, you know, kind of made everything, took what was mostly a younger, inexperienced team at that point and took them to a, you know, took them to a new level and added some, you know, added some veteran know-how, for a lack of a, to use a cliche.
Oh, yeah, and he was a really... He's just a great all-around player, I think. And like what you said, the player-coach thing was really interesting, especially at such a young age. I think that's the most, like, intriguing part of that, is just to be a coach. Especially we see it, like, with veterans, guys who are – or we saw it with veterans, guys who are, like, in their 30s, mid-30s, end of their careers. But to be that young and to have that responsibility says a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's such a strange one. Yeah, because you're right. Player coaches were still pretty common, but they were usually, you know, guys who were about 30 or older. So he was very close with Bill Bradley on and off the court. He retired in 74. Then he became the GM of the Nets, defecting to the ABA. And then he became the ABA commissioner, actually helped the with the NBA-ABA merger. And then was the Knicks GM in the 80s, drafting Patrick Ewing, was most notably. I think a lot of people know that, have seen that clip of him, like, being elated once it's revealed that the Knicks are going to get the, you know, the number one pick in the first draft lottery. So, and his book was The Open Man, A Championship Diary. And then, last but not least, Bill Bradley, who was a small forward. He didn't really – he and DeBuscher, their stats don't necessarily stand out, especially the advanced stats for them. Like, DeBuscher had a .105 winches of 48, which is just kind of right about average, and Bill Bradley had a .098, which is even below average. Now, I think there's a lot of evidence that they contribute in ways that don't necessarily show up in their production, but it's just sort of interesting that, given the reputation, that the stats don't necessarily match up with that. But Bradley was known as a guy, you know, moving without the ball, able to know exactly where he needed to be on the court, and able to kind of help, you know, make sure kind of everything was in its place and at the right rhythm, and able to do that. But, you know, he came in, he was an incredibly hyped college player at Princeton, actually had a rivalry with later teammate Cassie Russell, which would kind of continue on as they were players in the Knicks. Russell was the starter when Bradley came along, and Bradley eventually kind of replaced him as the starter, even though people thought Russell was the better one-on-one player, but thought that Russell, in terms of the team, fit better on the bench. But he was, you know, really this great white hope, which he, a role that he definitely was uncomfortable with. But when he came in, he got money comparable to Russell, to Bill Russell and Wilt Chamberlain. and had famously studied at Oxford before, after coming from Princeton. Actually played a year in Europe basketball before, you know, joining the Knicks a couple years after he was drafted. Of course, famous later for his political career, running. He was a U.S. senator from New Jersey for more than 20 years, ran for president in 2000, coming close to being the nominee but losing to Al Gore. And his book is Life on the Run from 1976. But yeah, but Bradley, he was booed initially for when he came to the Knicks. He definitely was not considered a huge disappointment. And then once the Busher got there, the team started winning and everything clicked and the cheers came.
And he's that classic, I guess, you know, like that quality role player who, like, and you were talking about his stats, not speaking to maybe his contributions, that like if the team's not as great, then he's not going to look as great. But then when the team is a contender, then he's going to look a lot better. So I guess he was that kind of player, you know, when he was playing for the Knicks. I guess he's the Robert Horry before Robert Horry, without the clutch shots and everything, or the notable clutch shots that gather all the attention. But yeah, like, you know, he's another really solid player. They had a lot of really good players who could just do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, the other notable ones, we'll get to Monroe and Lucas a little bit later, but Dick Barnett, who was a shooting guard, he was older at this point. He was actually close to his late 30s by the end of this run, and he had played everywhere. He was known for kind of his famous, he was left-hander, known for his famous sort of fallback baby fadeaway jumper. And was a very good player, another colorful personality there. And then Phil Jackson, of course, who I think everyone's pretty familiar with. He had actually missed out. He was with the team in 70 for the title, but had missed out on that because of the injury. So 73 obviously had an extra motivation for him. And then, you know, Coach Red Holzman, he had come in 68. And brought like a lot of more discipline, was fiery and defensive minded. It also had scouted and drafted most of the players, so he knew them very well. He knew kind of what they were capable of and had kind of a vision for how they fit together. And that really worked out very well for them. And even though they didn't get along, his approach to coaching reminded me a lot of Red Auerbach in terms of being kind of a guy who tried to treat his players like adults, empower his players, and not necessarily, I mean, he would be fiery, but he wouldn't necessarily be like, you know, my way or the highway. He would try to, you know, kind of be more collaborative with his players.
Yeah, I heard about that too, especially like from Phil. Phil talked a lot about him in different like interviews, and sort of sounded like he had a big role in sort of like how Phil Jackson approached the coaching players. And I don't know, it's an interesting route to go, and it obviously worked because the Knicks had a lot of unique personalities, but he knew how to work with them and work towards that one common goal.
Absolutely. They were pretty good in 69. They were 54 wins, fourth in the league. They actually led the league in SRS, but it was close between them and Baltimore and a couple of other teams. The Celtics and the Lakers all were similar quality teams that year. But they lost to the Celtics in the Eastern Division Finals 4-2. This was the final year for Bill Russell before he retired. So the end of that 11 titles in 13 years dynasty. But better things were to come for them. In fact, in the next season, 1970, they were 16-22, first in the league, first in SRS. And they beat the Lakers 4-3 in the finals, set a record 18-game winning streak that season. We've done other episodes on these finals and other shows, so we don't need to get into every detail necessarily. But obviously, you know, you being the Knicks fan, before we get, you know, deeper into 73, what do the 70s finals mean to you, especially the Game 7 dramatics?
Well, this is the first championship in franchise history. I think that's a big deal, and I think it's the situation just was like set up perfect. Like, it's the perfect story. So it's just the, you know, you're tied 2-2. Willis Reed gets hurt, and he has a torn muscle in his leg. And they win Game 5, get blown out in Game 6 in Los Angeles. And in Game 7, it's like everything's going against them. Like, the idea without your best player, or, you know, whatever you want, second best player. But, you know, he comes out, even though he probably isn't expected to play, and he, like, everybody responds to him coming out and hitting he hits two jump shots early on in, like, the first few possessions. And he comes out eventually and doesn't play the rest of the game. And they end up winning, like, rather easily. While Clyde Frazier has that amazing Game 7. It's, like, one of the best Game 7 performances in league history. And the fact that they were able to do that and, you know, miss Willis Reed for pretty much, you know, three games or, you know, 2.5, whatever you want to say, really just, it's the perfect story. I think that's what stands out about it the most.
Yeah, and one thing that's not really talked about is the Game 5 comeback. I mean, they were down 16 points at one point and were able to, you know, rally with some good bench play. You know, it was kind of the backup bigs who were able to take it to Wilt and able to, like, guys like Nate Bowman and Bill Hoskett. Not you know, obviously not big names, but they were able to key that comeback. You know, and the Knicks also won Game 3 despite Jerry West having that 60-foot shot that tied the game at the buzzer. So, I mean, the Game 7 game itself was not, you know, they won that by a huge blowout, but they, you know, won two very close, you know, they had clutch performances in two very close games that they could have easily lost and were able to, you know, pull out a championship and set the stage for what happened in Game 7 because of that. So, you know, those are kind of, you know, a little bit forgotten memories of that season, but absolutely, you know, deserve to be remembered.
Yeah, I agree. It's a big moment in franchise history.
And then Reed that year was the MVP of the All-Star game, the season and the finals, the first player to ever do that. Of course, this was only the second year for the finals MVP, so not many opportunities to do so, but still an impressive accomplishment. So the 71 season, they are 52-30, which is second in the league, but is way behind the 66 win Bucks. Their SRS is third in the league out of 17 teams. There were three teams added in expansion this year. And they were surprised in the Eastern Conference Finals. They lost to the Baltimore Bullets. Earl Monroe and Wes Unseld leading that team. Jack Maron also an important part of the team. So, you know, that the Bullets team was only they're 42-40 as a matter of fact. So that was a big surprise. Fred Carter also on that team. And Gus Johnson as well. So they had good players. Not really sure why they only ended up winning. They seemed like the team that should have won more games than they did. Kevin Locker on there too. So, you know, they had six pretty good, you know, named players on that team. So I don't know if it was injuries or just, you know, they just picked the right time to click. But the Bullets, they went to the finals, but then they ended up getting smashed by the Bucks anyway. They were swept in that series. So. Then the 72 season, and what's kind of fortunate for the Knicks and what's not really talked about is the Bucks ended up moving, actually they did in 71. So after 1970, they beat the Bucks during the playoffs. Kareem, was his rookie year. And then the second season they added Oscar Robertson, but then the team moved west. So they only had to be in the same conference with the Bucks for 1 year. And it'll be interesting given the powerhouse that the Bucks turned into and what a difficult time they had battling a almost equal powerhouse in the Lakers, how things would have been different if the Bucks had somehow ended up staying in the East and how that would have changed the Knicks' fortunes.
Yeah, that I know that actually when you think about it, that is sort of crazy. It could have affected a lot in terms of like both, you know, like where the Knicks would have ended up.
Yeah, I mean, because, I mean, certainly the Knicks could have beaten the Bucks in a, you know, they could have upset them in a playoff series, but any of those, you know, next three or four seasons, they are definitely going to be the underdog, have been the underdog in any of those series because the Bucks are routinely winning 60 games every year. And, like, you know, 71 and 72, they had, you know, two of the top five SRS seasons of all time. So, but the history worked out better for the Knicks. They ended up making the finals again in 72. They were, in the regular season, they were 48-34, which was seventh in the league. They were sixth in SRS. They ended up losing to the Lakers in the finals. Lakers that year won 69 games. And I talked to Sean Fury in a previous podcast talking about the Lakers side of things. During the offseason in 71, they acquired Jerry Lucas from the San Francisco Warriors. And then in November of 71, very early on in the season, they acquired Earl Monroe from the Baltimore Bullets, the team that had just beaten them in the playoffs. I don't think there was quite the fear over as there was in the Kevin Durant situation earlier this year. Of course, that was a lot of differences in that situation. But I do think the common thing parallel in the fact that Earl Monroe, his reputation and his kind of how he was viewed after that, going to like this power team of the Knicks and accepting a secondary role, how that sort of influenced how he was sort of seen as a player.
It definitely had an influence, I think, especially because when you're willing to take a backseat and sort of play behind, and not be the premier player that he wasn't with the Bullets, it says a lot of. I think it always like people always think about that as sort of like a character trait. If you're willing to accept being a role player, sort of taking a lesser role to compete for a championship or to play on a better team. So I think it's really cool that he did that. And I mean, it ended up working out because they ended up making advancing very far in the playoffs that year, making the finals. But it's really interesting just to see like how that trade works out and the Knicks, how he's willing to accept such a different role, which is hard, especially for him who's like, mid-career and, it's not like he's like way past his prime or something. And
he's still pretty young.
Yeah, so it's like for him to be in that position where, he's still relatively young and he has to take a back seat. I think that says a lot. And it definitely, he's loved like by Knicks fans too. Like people talk very fondly about him.
Yeah, and obviously, he had the incredible, the incredible arsenal of moves, the shaking and baking, the ball handling and skills, and just the trickery that he showed. The playground style game. I mean, obviously, he showed a lot of that stuff. Playing in the playgrounds. I think he was famous more for the Baker League in Philly. He played in the Rucker League as well, but he definitely, had this style of, incredible style of play and was an incredibly exciting guy. But he was going from this, more freewheeling team from the Bullets to a more conservative, structured Knicks team. There was worry from fans about him and whether he and Clyde would be able to share the ball, whether he would be able to play that well. And Monroe was like, yeah, I'm a basketball player. I can play that way. I play this way because it's the role that I'm asked, but I can play that way. And there were definitely some adjustments that he had to struggle with. And one of them in 72 was just he was dealing with some bad knees and some ankle problems, and he was limited to only 21.2 points a game and only averaged 11.9 points per game. But, once 73 came along, they actually he kind of got that starting role back, and then they started to form the legend that they would have as the Rolls-Royce backcourt. But there was some adjusting, and some of that I think was less him accepting a role than him just sort of, being hurt and having to accept it. But, they had the success that he had. But one thing that was important is that he didn't want to, when he went in, he was like, I want to come off the bench because I don't want to take Dick Barnett's place. I don't want to, take him off the bench. And he eventually did replace Barnett as Barnett was getting older. But, it was a sign that he was definitely willing to fit in and willing to accommodate the others to be successful.
It says a lot about him, and that's the stuff about him having to work with Clyde is just, I guess it's the natural progression of sort of just trying to work out the kinks of that whole chemistry and trying to work together on the court at the same time, which is never, it always sounds easy, and especially when it's two players who are willing to pass the ball, but it's always hard to get that first at the first try. It takes a lot of work, it seems.
You have to have a significant adjustment in the style that your player. You're used to having the ball in your hands, and then you suddenly don't. It's a big change, and obviously he deserves a lot of credit for adjusting to it and for them to making it work. I mean, that they have a lot of talent, so that helps. But it obviously worked out marvelously. So the Lucas trade, the Knicks trade Cazzy Russell, who had been a popular and successful player, important part of the first team, to the Warriors for Jerry Lucas. And Lucas, you know, he had kind of been sort of like, he was a, had produced big numbers, but had not had much team success at all. You know, he really had a weak Royals team for the most part. Didn't really have a strong supporting cast, other than, of course, Oscar Robertson. And he later said that all those years in Cincinnati were pretty frustrating. I thought for the longest time that there was no way I would ever be in a championship club. He had also kind of developed some poor work habits and being out of shape. And he later kind of conceded that when he went to San Francisco. And he said, the last 4 years with the Royals, I didn't work as hard as I could have. Then it ended up, after a year and a half in San Francisco, with not really much to show for it there, he ended up going to the Knicks and really helping kind of revive his career. Ended up having a big role with the team because Reed, as we mentioned, played only about 11 games that season, didn't really have much of a role. So he had to step in and played a bigger role than he expected, and he thrived. He was able to change from forward to center, which was a better position for him, and he was able to help revive his career. He's also known for sort of being a little bit of an eccentric personality. He had all these memory games where he just had this what you might call a photographic memory, where he's able to like memorize like the first 500 pages of the Manhattan phone directory. Would later like write a bunch of books, including the memory book, about learning how to memorize things. Definitely an interesting personality. Kind of a guy who gets a little bit forgotten today, which is a little surprising because he was such a character and such a, and you know, a top 50 player of all time, but isn't necessarily a guy who's necessarily like on the tip of the tongue when you kind of are thinking about the legends of the 60s and 70s.
He had a big time role with the Knicks and played such a big factor. And I guess maybe some of that stuff of not being on great teams and sort of just early on in his career and not just putting, like, you know, sometimes I think when players put up big numbers and the team doesn't do as well, people sort of put them in this like role where they're just, oh, you're just a guy who puts up numbers and you're not really about winning. But I mean, especially later in his career, he had so much success, so it's weird to see that he doesn't really get that much attention.
Yeah, I think part of that might be because he came on late to the team. And, you know, again, the premise of the show is that the 70 team is so well-regarded, but the 73 team doesn't quite have as much of a legend to it. And the fact that he's part of the later team is just, you know, is kind of part of that thing, despite the fact that, obviously they had a lot of success. But there's a really good, from When the Garden Was Eaten, talking about the night that Monroe had been traded from the Bullets to the Knicks, and he'd had a big salary dispute with the Bullets, and that was kind of an ugly situation where another time where kind of ownership was didn't really have the resources it needed to keep him, and the team was kind of in a weird transition, so they had a difficult time. But that was also the same night. It was the first time that Cazzy Russell had played against the Knicks since being traded to Golden State. So, you know, Cazzy's in there, and just, you know, it was strange for him coming as an opponent, and then the bench unit, which were known as the Minutemen, had broken up, and Monroe and Lucas were in a Knicks uniform, and it was a moment of saying, wow, this is really different. But at the same time, life teaches you to move on. So it was, you know, he was happy because he was actually, you know, he'd be kind of coming off the bench with the Knicks, and going to the Warriors enabled him to have a bigger role and to score more, but you know, he had some lingering regret over, you know, leaving. And Monroe kind of felt that a little bit later over leaving Baltimore, too. He kind of felt like when he went to the Knicks, it was somebody else's team. It was Clyde's team. When you have your own team, you know when you're going to take over games. You know when to feed people to keep them happy. Going to New York, I had to learn when to do that, even more when not to do stuff. So he did have a little bit of like, obviously he was happy, you know, he had a good career with the Knicks and he won the championship and everything, but there was at least part of him that kind of wondered how he would be seen and, you know, how things would have gone when he went to the Bulls, which, you know, is understandable.
Yeah, definitely, to me it makes sense.
So one other thing I think worth noting about this is that before he was traded to the Knicks, Monroe actually visited with the Indiana Pacers and who were in the ABA, and was thinking about signing with them. And he went to a game, and the Pacers won. And then went to the locker room, and he got along with everybody. Then he noticed that all the black players reached over their lockers and started bringing guns down. He was shocked to see this and said, "Why do you guys have guns?" And he said, "They've got the KKK everywhere around here, outside Indianapolis and in the city too, so we got guns to protect ourselves," which was basically like, "Oh, nope, I'm not coming to Indianapolis."
that's a crazy story.
The guns in the locker room is mentioned in Loose Balls, but it's more of like these guys kind of like were into like kind of the idea of like being cowboys, and they would carry around guns and, you know, just kind of be goofy and stuff. The racial violence of it aspect, either it wasn't mentioned at all, either it wasn't known about, or it just wasn't, you know, brought into the book. But I think it was actually from Earl Monroe's book, which I haven't had a chance to read yet. Obviously sort of an added fascinating aspect and obviously frightening aspect of basketball life during that time.
I agree. It's that's a scary thing to think about.
Yeah. As you mentioned, that 72 team, they lost to the Lakers in the finals, the Lakers being the 69 win team. So not much of a, loss there. And so then, they're going into a 73 season. They put Earl Monroe into the starting lineup. They are a 57 win team. They have their fourth in the league of SRS, a stronger regular season team. And they are able to beat the Lakers in the finals. They add Monroe to the starters with Reed, DeBuscher, Bradley, and Frazier. Off the bench, they have Jackson, Lucas, Barnett, and also John Gianelli and Dean Memminger. Other than of course, the 60s Celtics teams, I'm not sure how many teams have six Hall of Famers as a players who are, like the six main players plus two Hall of Fame coaches. Holzman, the coach of the team, and then Jackson, of course, would become a Hall of Famer as a coach.
It's nearly impossible. I always feel like, especially like looking back on that, it sounds like it's impossible. It sounds like a dream because, to be that deep and to have that much talent on your team, it usually leads to championships or close to championships. So just to see that they had all of those players, and then also just that they all like worked well together. I think that's the bigger thing also, is that we have all these great players, but the chemistry is just perfect. Everything works out and they all play together. It says a lot about how unique the situation is and how hard it is to really capture all of that together, even when you have that much talent.
Yeah, absolutely. And still adding new components to the team too. Obviously by now, this is the second season for Lucas and Monroe, so they're more integrated as part of things, but that's certainly a challenge to be able to integrate all those guys. So Reed and Lucas at this point are splitting time at center, which was a little tricky for both of them being used to being starters, but Reed talked about, I had to accept it. Red said some nights will start, some you won't. And, obviously the success was good. For Bradley, said that for me, the most fun I ever had playing basketball was the 1973 team. So he had fond memories of the team. And it was interesting to counter that with Walt Frazier, who basically said that, he remembers 1970 so well, but barely, or if at all, remembers 1973, particularly the finals, which they would, win the championship in Los Angeles. And there will be not necessarily the level of hoopla that they had, winning it in such a game and such an atmosphere in 1970, winning at home in Game 7.
I think that's the biggest reason why why they feel that way. It's just the situation. I think a Game 7 at home versus a 4-1 win is just, I think that's like a big reason why there is that feeling that the 1971 is such a much more important one. I think because it always feeds into like this idea of like a narrative, like a story that sounds like great to read or listen to when it's being told, versus, oh, we lost the first game, but then we won 4-1.
Exactly.
You boil it down like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Knicks this season, they had a lot of comebacks. Regular season game early on in the season, November 72, they were down 86-68 to the Bucks at home. But they scored the final 19 points in 5 minutes and 11 seconds to win the game, one of the most dramatic comebacks in NBA history. So more of a footnote than anything, but it's sort of a very famous regular season game. And I believe that's the biggest comeback at that point of the game in NBA history. I mean, it certainly would, if it's not the most, it certainly would have to be up there because that's almost impossible. And especially in the pre-3-point era, to be able to do that is pretty amazing.
Wait, how could that happen? You're 5'11", it must have been a lot of fast breaks because I can't imagine that happened.
They ended up beating the Bullets in the Eastern Conference semifinals, and they actually faced the Bullets every year from 69 through 74. And they won 5 of those matches, only losing once, of course, in 71. And the NBA had actually adopted a new playoff this year where the regular season record would determine home court in the playoffs, not their seed. So the Bullets were the second seed because they won the division, but the Knicks had home court because they had a better record, which changed the playoff system that was kind of wacky because for a while the top two teams in the division would make the playoffs no matter the record. So you would have a case of like much worse teams from one division making it over much better teams from another division just because of, you know, the alignment issues that they had. I mean, obviously there are still some things like that with playoff seeding today, you know, when there's conference imbalance, but it's a much different case of like a high 40s win team not making the playoffs versus, you know, what usually happens where like a low 40s win team gets cut off because of situations like that. So anyway, the Knicks won the series fairly easy. It wasn't necessarily a memorable series, but they had some battles with the Bullets, and the fact that they faced off 6 years in a row in the Eastern Conference playoffs, you know, it's one thing for that to happen in a league where there's only 8 teams, but at this point there were like 17 teams, so interesting that they continued to face off in the Knicks, obviously, for the most part, getting the better of that rivalry.
And Earl Monroe playing against his former team, that must have also added to the battle and much attention it would have because of just how much he didn't want to be there after his issues with the team over his issues with the Bullets. So that definitely must have added some fuel to the fire.
Yeah, I believe there were Benedict Monroe signs up. So. During that series, so the fans were not so quick to forgive him, and then that obviously that lot like losing him probably changed the fortunes of the franchise. I mean they may have moved to Washington anyway. I mean he was popular but not necessarily like a transcendent star, and you know, like where keeping him wouldn't necessarily keep the team in the city, but you know, it certainly, you know, it had to have at least some effect. So then the Knicks beat the Celtics in the Eastern Conference Finals. Depending on your point of view, I discussed this with Bob Ryan when we talked about the mid-70s Celtics, but depending on your point of view, either the Knicks had such a dramatic, furious comeback in Game 4, beating the Celtics in double overtime, or the Celtics were cheated by some refs who unfortunately, emotions got the better of them and took it away from the Celtics. So we'll let the listeners decide, but the Knicks came back big in this game. They were down 17 points in the third quarter, and then Frazier hit a fall-away jumper with 17 seconds left in the fourth to tie the game. Then Phil Jackson tied the game at the first overtime, had two free throws to send to a second overtime. And then due to injuries and foul outs, the entire second overtime for the Knicks was played by Walt Frazier, DeBuscher, Henry Bibby, Gianelli, who was a rookie center, and Phil Jackson. Jackson stole the ball from JoJo White and had a big layup to open the period, and then Gianelli was able to draw Dave Cowens' 6th foul, and then the Knicks ended up winning the game by 7. Celtics coach Tom Heinsohn berated the referees for what he thought was a bunch of unfair calls against the team. So, at that point, they were up 3-1, but then the Celtics battled back despite not having John Havlicek Havlicek sort of being in and out with injury, and they lost games 5 and 6, and they were headed back to Boston for game 7 in Boston Garden, where the Celtics had never lost a game 7. However, the Celtics were able to come back. Dean Memminger came in for Monroe and played really well. Helped give the Knicks an early lead. And then DeBuscher was able to defend Cowens pretty well. And then Lucas and Reed came in the second half to, and even did even better. And then eventually the Knicks held on to the win, which Rhett Holzman later recalled the most satisfying of his career. Frazier had 25 points and 10 rebounds in that game in 47 minutes of play. So a big win to hold off, rising, talented young Celtics team that was going to be primed to be a great team, over the next few years.
Anytime you beat the Celtics, it's definitely something to be proud of and to be happy about, because Boston, especially throughout the Russell era and leading into this new one, as they started bringing up, as they still were one of the best teams in basketball.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually remarkable how quickly they kind of were able to recalibrate themselves. But, the Knicks and the Celtics, I believe they would play 3 years in a row in the playoffs, with the Knicks winning the first two and then the Celtics knocking them off in 74. So this point, they go to they're facing the Lakers again in the finals for the third time in 4 years. Both teams are aging. Jerry West is 35, Will Chamberlain 36, Dick Barnett is 36, and then DeBuscher, Reed, Bradley, and Lucas are all in their early 30s, which is, older in basketball standards than it is today. And then by winning this series and by beating the Boston in the East Finals, Boston actually was a 68-win team. They were the first team to beat 60-win squads en route to a championship in the playoffs. So, fun fact for them. In Game 1, the Knicks lost Game 1 in Los Angeles. They had beaten the Celtics on a Sunday, and then they had to face the Lakers on a Tuesday. The Knicks had requested the delay to the start of the finals until Wednesday, but the Lakers said no way. The Knicks basically or the Lakers basically smoked the Knicks during for most of the game. Chamberlain had 7 blocks, and the Lakers did jump out to a huge lead. Eventually, the Knicks did sort of make it close, but the Lakers were able to hold on in the end. However, that was it. The Knicks came back in Game 2. They were able to play better defense and basically slow down the Lakers' fast break that had led them to so much success. Even after shooting struggles in Game 3 from Bill Bradley and DeBuscher, they were able to kind of survive that. West had 2 strained hamstrings to slow him down. Chamberlain was slowing down at this point. This would be his he would retire after this season. Actually, he would try to defect the jump to the ABA and play, but a contract obligation forced him to only be able to coach the team, which is a situation we will discuss in the future over and back Basketball Mysteries of the 70s. But the Knicks were able to sort of grind that one out, and they won another close one in Game 4, winning 103-98, which sets a Game 5 in the Forum, another tough one. But the Knicks able to win down the stretch despite DeBuscher going out in the fourth period with a sprained ankle. And then Earl Monroe came in the clutch. He scored 8 points over the final 2 minutes to finish. And the Knicks won 102-93 and were able to seal that championship. And actually, I believe there was not footage of that game available for many years. But recently, within the last 5 years, it was rediscovered again. Somebody had a reel of it, and it's able to be viewed now after all these years, which is kind of a neat thing. And I guess maybe the fact that no one could see that game almost immediately after that game was played maybe adds a little bit to just it not being available, means not as talked about or as mythologized as the 70 tape, which obviously is much more readily available.
I think there's some truth to that. I think that also what's really interesting is just that in that series, just the Knicks, the 4 wins were a relative, they were all single-digit victories. So it's really cool that they won all these close games in after losing the first game. And so weird. You don't see that a lot. So I thought that was really... I don't even know how to describe it. That's
yeah, it's unusual for that many... for the all 5 were very close games. The furthest margin was 9 in the final game. The rest were 5 or less. So that's obviously pretty impressive. Interesting that that Willis Reed got the Finals MVP, although I don't know if there's really a player who, like, absolutely, you could say, definitely deserves it on the team. Although Frazier played 230 minutes versus Reed's 150 minutes in the series, and the stat lines were similar, so there isn't necessarily one of those that stand out. But you definitely could argue he was hosed in the 1970 Finals MVP after he had that great game, but was overshadowed by Reed's dramatic entrance. But maybe you could say the same in 73 as well. I guess Reed was kind of the choice by default because there was everyone. I mean, the point averages were 18.6 for Bradley, 16.6 for Frazier, 16.4 for Reed, 16.0 for Monroe, and 15.6 for DeBuscher. So five guys, with basically even production on that end.
It's what stood out about that team throughout that whole run is just they had so many different guys who could score, and it made for a very tricky decision. Or I guess not very tricky, since Willis Reed got the MVP both times.
I think it was a petition thing, and obviously the people who voted on it saw the series, and I didn't, so they have a better. I only have the numbers to go by and some limited other things, but. Anything else you want to talk about as far as this Knicks dynasty goes? They would kind of have one more pretty strong year in 74. They would finish fifth in the league with 49 wins and fifth in SRS as well, lose to the Celtics in Eastern Conference Finals fairly handily, and that would be about it. Reed and DeBuscher and Lucas would retire, and they would kind of move on to a new era with like Bob McAdoo and Spencer Haywood trying to bring those high-priced guys in, that not really working out. And then what kind of stands out to you as far as the Knicks team goes and where it's the special place that it has in the hearts of Knicks fans?
What stands out to me is that it's such a unique roster with so much talent. I think that's what stands out. The Knicks have never had that kind of group of talent since that time. Because even during the Patrick Ewing years, and even the Bernard King before that little stretch in the 80s when he was a dominant player, they've never really had great overall talent. You think of John Starks or Charles Oakley as the supporting players, or Bill Cartwright as a supporting player to Bernard King. And, like, they're good players. They're, like, fringe all-stars, guys who might have made one or two all-star teams. And they're, like, okay. But the Knicks have never really had a collective of stars to play together like they had with Frazier and Reed and DeBuscher, three, like, also the guys who are all-stars every year. And you also have people like Monroe, and then you have Jerry Lucas, who was an all-star in the other place before. You have all of these guys who've had accomplished careers throughout their time in the NBA before they get to that point of even winning the championship in 1973. So I think that's what stands out the most, is just that collective of talent and finding a way to make it all work, because just the Knicks have always been, it's always important to get the star. I think that obviously is always important. So getting that Carmelo or getting Patrick Ewing or getting Bernard King, getting that first player is obviously the most important part. But you also have to surround your best players with a cast worthy of good chemistry and good fit, but also like quality talent too, that they can, that the other player is not, the superstar is not taxed, or the semi-superstar is not taxed too much and has to do too much. And we've seen throughout all of these runs that the Knicks have had with other eras is just either Patrick Ewing is too taxed. I mean, the Knicks like over-relied on him, especially during a time when teams literally only posted up 100% of the time. They relied on Patrick Ewing so much. And then we even see with this current Knicks era that the Knicks over-rely on Carmelo Anthony offensively too much. And And, you know, even when Bernard King single-handedly won them a playoff series against Detroit when they had, and Isaiah Thomas, that first round series they played, I forget what year it was, but
I think it was 84.
So they, you know, they've always had these situations where they're over relying on a superstar. But in the case of the 1970s Knicks, they weren't over relying. No one was stretching themselves too thin. It was always a group of guys who played together, and all of them had enough talent and the trust in their teammates that they knew that they didn't have to do too much or overstep their bounds to, you know, for the team to win. They just had to play well as a team, as a group, as a collective to win. Yeah. I think that stands out the most to me.
Yeah, and it's very, you know, feels very Spurs-esque. You know, it's sort of a modern example of that kind of spirit and that kind of having the sacrificing superstar and the guys who more about, you know, like the team success than the numbers. And obviously Spurs have held on to it for a long time. And, you know, they had Tim Duncan, who, you know, is a, you know, bona fide all-time, you know, probably top 10 player of all time. The Knicks had some very good players but and some top 50 players, but no one quite that good. I think the spirit of it is definitely there, and that's certainly a, you know, I mean, it's hard to build a team that way too, because it's hard to get a bunch of good players together who want to sacrifice and who want to play well and who, you know, just have the understanding of the game and the complementary. I mean, the Knicks had such smart, you know, secure players, guys who were secure in their own skin and willing to, you know, not worry about things that were, you know, more than just winning. You know, not that they didn't have their problems like everyone does, but they, you know, for the most part, they were able to, you know, kind of overcome it and were mature and were grown-ups and were just guys who, you know, had a good attitude and played hard and played well and played together. So anyway, thanks everyone for checking us out. We really appreciate following along with our Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s series. Hopefully you're enjoying it. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Both of them are at Over and Back NBA. And leave us a rating and review if you want to on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen to your podcast. And you can find us at harvardforautism.com. And thanks for checking us out. And until next time, see you again.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.